Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who has never misjudged anyone quite so badly as we did Paula Moore. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And we're embarking on Colin Baker's first full season of The Doctor with the nostalgia fest that is Attack of the Cybermen. This is a Doctor Who story that some people love for all its continuity references, and equally some people hate it for all of its continuity references. Todd, what do you think?
I love it.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. I mean,
Look, you know, I was 12 or 13 at the time, and, you know, it's referencing all these things like the 10th Planet, the Tomb of the Cybermen, even, you know, the Lytton stuff, the terrible Zoden, which is one of my all-time favourite jokes, which I've mentioned before. And I am Foreman, you know, the TARDIS changing. I really adore part one of this two-part story, like nothing else.
The continuity references are really funny because they're a different kind of continuity from what we're able to experience now, because we've actually had the opportunity to see all of those stories. And those of us on this flight have actually even seen the stories that don't exist. So we know what's being referred to. And I think even things like Wheel in Space are sort of hinted at.
Mm.
But what was available back in the 1980s was essentially the Doctor Who monster book. And so no one had really seen Tomb of the Cybermen. It hadn't been rediscovered then.
Not for another 7 years after this.
It was nearly impossible to see the 10th Planet. And so all of those things, it gets horribly wrong, doesn't it? I mean, all of the continuity stuff is kind of incorrect.
Well, visually, the continuity is wrong, but the references made in the script are correct. You know, the Doctor mentions that Mondas will approach Earth in a year's time, which that in itself is an interesting idea. They're not basing it at the same time as that is happening. It's a preventative plot by the Cybermen. What it reminded me of, and I think I watched this at around the same time when I was a child, is Return to Oz, the sequel to The Wizard of Oz made 50 years afterwards. So visually, it's incredibly different. Scarecrow appears in one scene and is an animatronic rather than Ray Bolger, of course. But at the same time, I think as a child you kind of accept those visual inconsistencies. Perhaps now as an adult we might look at it and say, that's a bit off. This seems like a good time to talk about authorship of this story. I mentioned Paula Moore in my introduction, who this story is credited to. And even in Doctor Who The Complete History, the new artwork from Doctor Who Magazine, our sponsors at Doctor Who Magazine, they don't sponsor it. But even in that book, there's pretty much a paragraph saying, we still don't quite know who wrote this. So the current working idea is that Eric Saywood came up with the story, wrote the script with an ex-girlfriend of his, Paula Woolsey, who was trying to break in as a television writer, put it under the name Paula Moore, with continuity input from Ian Levine. But Ian Levine has also said that he and Eric wrote the script together to the point that they sort of hothoused it over a weekend, and about 18 hours in, Ian's like, look, I don't think this story is working, I want to go home, to which Saywood replied, if you want to write a script for the show, this is your only chance. I'll make you a star, kind of thing. Ian has been on record as saying, you know, yes, I suggested the cyber tombs, but I said build them in exactly the same way, and instead they build these sort of
freak rooms,
these big Tesco refrigerators kind of thing. Even then, I don't mind that design, but yeah, it's a strange decision to steep it in so much continuity, but then update the design.
Yeah. I mean, the Cybermen of the 1980s are absolutely nothing at all like the Cybermen in the 10th Planet. And I'm not sure what the references to the 10th Planet add to the story apart from some really bad word peril. And I guess the worst example of that is when in episode one, the Doctor and Perry are in the control room looking at that lamentable special effect that's supposed to represent Halley's Comet on the screen, and Perry complaining that she's very scared, but it's actually hard to tell why. It's not something I think that sort of lands. And there is just something a little bit tiresome and a little bit routine about, you know, the Cybermen are somehow going back in time and preventing, you know, Mondas from exploding or whatever, when none of that stuff is really present to anyone in the audience except the Doctor Who Monster Book reading contingent.
It's funny, I have a completely different take on this from everybody else. I don't have a problem with the redesign of the tombs. I just accept that it's a different part of the tomb system. Eric's rewriting history by introducing the Kryons, who've come up with the refrigeration on Telos. And, you know, I don't think that necessarily contradicts anything that's ever been said. It's just never been said.
Yeah. Mm.
And the fact that it's like 15 years or 16 years after, I would never expect them to do the tombs exactly the way that they were, since this story doesn't exist at this point in the archives. Obviously now we're used to CGI and all continuity references in shows and going back. So you would think that if it was done now that they would do it in the style of. And I think it's, for me, it's just not a problem, right?
Having
the redesign there. They try to do two levels, you know, it's their own take on it. For me, the whole thing is the fact that this is completely consistent with the production team of Eric Saward and John Nathan Turner over the last 3 years, in that the first story of every season is their attempt to rewrite Doctor Who history in some way.
Yeah, but I hadn't noticed that, but you're right.
And so here, you know, they're going back to, as I said, Tomb of the Cybermen, 10th Planet, things that people at this point don't really know but are lauded as fantastic, and they're putting their own spin on it through the Kryons and that sort of thing. Last year, Eric got Johnny Byrne to do, again, the Silurians and the Sea Devils with, you know, the Merkers, the new element there, and different continuity going back to the Silurians and the Sea Devil stories that people love but not necessarily had seen. The year before that, they've done their take on Omega, which is a completely different take. You know, he's got a TARDIS. They've introduced the Ark of Infinity so he can get from antimatter to matter, so referencing back to the Three Doctors. And even the year before that with the Master, it's now the Master of Literal Disguise as opposed to figuratively. This is completely consistent, you know. They're pandering more and more to the Doctor Who audience, and it's their take on things and they're reworking. And, you know, they're even a year ahead, they're planning to go back even further to the mythical, magical, celestial toy maker and rewrite that. So and a lot of the exposition is actually in part two of this 45-minute story when they're aboard the TARDIS, where there's an info dump from hell, which I really love, right? But I completely understand if casual viewers are going, what the hell is this, you know, and why is this? I guess the biggest thing is the cyber controller. We now know that the cyber controller appears to be completely destroyed. But, you know, here he's merely damaged, according to the cyber leader. Mm. I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, I think quite often, you know, even Moffat in all of the stuff that he does now will say people have died, but it's like, that's not really the whole story. Cybermen we now see can download from one to another. So I'm quite happy with the fact that he was merely damaged could mean that, you know, in the moment of death, his whole consciousness is downloaded to a new cyber controller. And we don't have 5 minutes of exposition of how that happened.
I think the big problem with the cyber controller is not the explanation for how he got here, but how truly, truly terrible he is. And I think Russell T. Davis has mentioned that he has a really strong memory of the cyber controller. And remember, the cyber controller from Tomb of the Cybermen didn't have a chest unit, so he was really sleek and slim. He was super tall, and he had that huge dome on his head that was transparent and seemed to be glowing. It's a little bit hard to tell in black and white. And I think Russell imagined that the brain was sort of visible through it. There are certainly veins or something.
Yeah.
And then Russell used that design both in Rise of the Cybermen, or Age of Steel rather, and in The Next Doctor. where you can see the brain visible in the Cybermen. So it was a really striking, memorable design. And I really liked that cyber controller. And that was played by Michael Kilgariff, who would go on to play the K-1 robot in Robot, and who has been cast as the cyber controller here 148 years later. And he's eaten a lot of pies since the shooting of Tomb of the Cybermen, and he's really fat. And he's not the only fat Cyberman. His offsider is also got a pretty hefty backside on him as well. And he didn't do the voice. Remember back then the voices in Tomb of the Cybermen, the voices were wonderful. They were almost completely incomprehensible. Yeah, wonderful, just terrific. But here it's the sort of crappy sub Darth Vader voices that David Banks stars. So the cyber controller just looks terrible. Like, he just looks stupid. He's got a big cone head for no readily apparent reason with sort of rivets on it. He weighs 130 kilograms in the shade. He waves his arms around and does a sort of terrible, terrible Michael Kilgariff voice. And his offsider, like so many Cybermen offsiders, have these sort of stupid posh voices as well. So all of those scenes where he's talking in the control room are just terrifically bad.
It is a fat controller.
It's really bad. I just love it. Fat. I just love it. I love it, the fact that it's a fat controller. I love it, the fact that they've redesigned it with the dome head. I just sit there just chuckling away at the crapness of the Cybermen and their entire plan and the fact that they will be defeated. Yeah. So I just enjoy it. I mean, he wasn't originally going to be cast. They offered the part to David Banks and he turned it down. So then, of course, they went to him. Let's go back to episode one.
Yeah.
So this season is the first season that's actually Doctor Who's in 45-minute episodes.
Yeah.
The decision that was made in light of the previous season, Resurrection of the Daleks, its episodes were edited together so that it went out in two parts rather than four, and the then controller of the BBC said, oh, look at these wonderful ratings, you know, which weren't really that much better than the rest of the season. And, you know, yes, let's go to 45 minutes for this coming season.
It was already in the offing that they were thinking of doing that because they were having to prepare the scripts, and that just kind of solidified it. So it was like, it was sort of 75% decided and they did a test and it's like, hey, that works really well. And I think Attack of the Cybermen is one of the stories where it works better in this story than other stories of this season, because the temptation for them is going to be the structure of the first episode of any Doctor Who story in the 80s, at any rate, is the first 10 minutes are used setting up the world. And then we come to the TARDIS, and the TARDIS arrives at around the 15-minute mark, just in time for them to get into trouble in the first cliffhanger. Now, this doesn't happen in Attack of the Cybermen. They do arrive in London within the first 15 minutes of the 45 minutes. But it'll become a problem further on in the season where they still kind of take the idea that the TARDIS shouldn't arrive until three quarters of the way through a 45-minute episode. And that will become a problem. In terms of these 45-minute episodes, of course, they became 25-minute episodes in Australia. They were just sort of chopped in half without much thought as to where the cliffhanger went. Now, the new episode one cliffhanger of this one actually isn't too bad. It's the Doctor and Perry down in the sewers. And you see one of the Black Scout Cybermen come up behind them and the titles kick in. So that works as a cliffhanger. We'll get some pretty terrible cliffhangers in Vengeance on Varos. I can't remember what the episode three cliffhanger to this one is. I think it might be Litten getting caught or something.
No, I think it's one of the Kryons saying for Mondas to survive, the Earth must be destroyed. I think that's the end of episode three.
Yeah, you're right, actually. And that's a good cliffhanger. So this works as a four-parter and as a two-parter.
Can I just say, I love all these fake cliffhangers that we got here in Australia.
Like, yeah. I think we should make a point of mentioning them. I've got a particular favourite in the two doctors.
My favourite's in the two doctors.
Is that the...
No, we're not going to mention it now. We're going to wait, sorry.
I will say when we get to it next week, the ones in Vengeance on Varos for the new episodes one and three are particularly hilariously dire, but we'll get to those.
One of the things about, obviously, listeners, for overseas sales, everything was restructured for 25 minutes or 22 and a half minutes, but it's literally who's ever there is taking no notice of what scenes are before or after, and you know, maybe we'll wait 30 seconds because there's a better cliffhanger. It's literally at that mark, boom, and you know, sometimes there's better cliffhangers around there, like through coincidence or whatever.
Well, I actually wondered whether there had been some plans to do this in four parts at some point, or when it was devised it might be like that, because at the halfway point, that is where Lytton meets the Cybermen. We get the proper big episode one, you know, monster reveal cliffhanger. So it did seem to be there. I have to disagree. I don't think the 45-minute structure works in this story at all, and for precisely the reasons that Brendan identifies, where they tend to make part one of this two-part story like a 25-minute part one. And so 17, 18 minutes in, the Doctor and Perry, even though they've arrived in London, all they've done is walk up and down some laneways and talk to one another, and they haven't really interacted with anyone or joined the story at any point.
See, I'm going to disagree with you on that. I actually think this is one of the best 45-minute part ones. They have a bit of a talk in the TARDIS, you know, their usual tete-a-tete, where it's not too bad in terms of having an argument. I think it's worse than the next story. And then they're out exploring London. The Doctor's trying to find this alien, you know. Although they haven't met the characters, they are involved with the plot because they're trying to get to the plot.
It is so well done. And something Eric Saywood has said about his concept for this script was he felt that Twin Dilemma wasn't a good start for the character and it wasn't a good start for the relationship. So I think we kind of need the 15 minutes of just the two of them together to reestablish this relationship in a better way. And there is still tension between them, but there is a lot more warmth. They're making jokes with each other. And there's a beautiful moment halfway through the episode where they kind of give up the search and the Doctor can't think of what to do, and Perry's the one who raises the point of, well, even if he's not there, he'll need to know if people turn up. And the Doctor turns to her and tells her, you're absolutely brilliant. And it mitigates some of the tension we've had already. But also there's some really cute moments, like where she's having a go about his memory and he does the very Doctorish thing of ignoring her concern but going, oh, I called you Zoden, did I?
No, I think the funny thing there is that she describes his memory as seeming like it had gone through a mincer, and she elaborates on that a little bit and he says, that's a terrible simile. I actually think I went into this expecting to dislike Colin much, much more than I did, and all of the moments of conflict and when he's rude to her and unlikable, which is a deliberate choice that the production team is making, all of those moments are terrible. They're awful. And I really, really wish that they hadn't gone that way. It was a bad, bad idea. When he's called upon to do warmth, he does it really well.
Yeah.
And when he's called upon to be silly and overconfident about his abilities but wrong. So when he's repairing the TARDIS at the beginning and he sort of stuffs it up and it goes wrong, but he's super confident that it's going to be okay, whenever he does that, he's really, really funny and really quite sweet. And there's even one moment, you know, people criticise this because the Doctor's violent, and there is that scene in episode one with the policeman where the Doctor leaps down that hole and then comes back up with the policeman's helmet, and Perry's already overcome the other policeman, and she asks the Doctor, where's the policeman? And he says, oh, I think he's having a little lie down somewhere.
Yeah.
I just think that's really terrific. Really quite fun.
I think there's nothing wrong with that. We've seen as early as Hartnell, the Doctor has no objection to a bit of fisticuffs. And I think Eric Saywood makes the very clever decision. And look, let's just face it, Saywood wrote this.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Eric Saywood makes the very clever decision that the Doctor's fist fight with the policeman is done off camera.
I agree.
I think with Colin Baker's Doctor, I've mentioned this before with him, because he is such a physically imposing presence, by that I mean he's over 6 foot tall, he is well built. If you ran into the Sixth Doctor in an alleyway and he was annoyed with you and holding a broken bottle, you would fear for your life, kind of thing. If you ran into Hartnell in a dark alley and he was holding a broken bottle, it'd just be an average Saturday night for him. But the less we can show of the Sixth Doctor being physically imitably violent, the better. Flashing forward to the end of the story where Newsflash, he goes berserk with a cyber gun, I also don't have a problem with that.
No, that's horrible.
I don't have a problem with it either.
It's horrible, but it is apt in that situation. And it's not like he jumps out of the TARDIS and grabs the first gun he can find. It's a matter of he comes under attack and grabs a gun to defend himself.
Yeah. But I just don't think the scriptwriter should be putting him in that position. And like that is a particularly horrible one where, you know, he shoots the cyber controller with a big gun at point blank range. You know, things come out of the cyber controller's head. And that has been the culmination of, you know, I think the story degenerates in episode two and just becomes the usual Sayward people shooting one another with guns thing that we've had over and over again. And it's boring and I really dislike it. In episode one, there is that scene where Perry has a gun. I think it's unfortunate that the companion chooses to carry a gun, but whatever. But again, I really like Colin's comic timing in the scene where he tells Perry to shoot the policeman. Shoot him, Perry. And it's really offhanded, you know, oh, I'm sick of this, shoot him, you know. And we don't believe that for a second. We know he's joking. And Colin's comic timing is wonderful.
Unfortunately, there is a line cut from the script when they're going down the sewers and Perry unclips the silencer and whatever. Perry is meant to say, I don't actually know how to use this, but no one else knows that, so it could come in handy.
Right.
It kind of explains why when the doctor says shoot him, you know, she's both nervous that she's been asked to shoot someone, but it's also, I've told you I don't know how to use this thing. The weird thing was there was also a bit in the script originally where Perry comments that the guns the policemen have are illegal in the States. And the doctor responds something along the lines of, oh, yes, well, you can always trust British police ingenuity. And I think they may have cut it because of that second line as being right. critical of the police. But, yeah, the concept that there might be a gun that's illegal in America.
It's unimaginable.
Yeah, I know.
So back to episode one again. I'm going to disagree with Nathan on a few things that he's now said about the doctor and Perry relationship and being horrible to Perry. I don't actually see him being particularly horrible to Perry at all. I just think it's the nature of their relationship. And I actually think if Eric Sayward instructed all of his scriptwriters throughout the season to write all the light stuff and the comic stuff for Colin and the warmth, plus some of the tension, people wouldn't have as much problem with the rest of the season. I think it's quite ironic that in the two stories that he writes, he actually writes better than Robert Holmes, for example, or even Philip Martin coming up in terms of the Dr. Perry having big fights and that sort of thing. Or even Pip and Jane Baker, where I think is actually probably the worst relationship of the entire season. But we'll talk about that when we get to it. I just think Colin's performance throughout this entire story, he's just got, you know, when a new doctor comes in, I just love the energy. Like you may recall, listeners, that I really love John in his first season and I actually picked his performance in that over everybody else with season 11. I love Tom in his first season. Colin's performance in this, and I was speaking to Richard about this, we just adored it. And even Richard said to me, "This he thinks this is possibly Colin's best performance as the Doctor." Now, I'm not going to necessarily say that, but I just think throughout all of this story, the warmth, the bits of silliness that you've mentioned, and even when he gets irritable, I just think he's great.
I think that there's a weakness that I identified, I think, last week in the Pete retrospective, which is that Sayward can't write convincing dialogue. And his dialogue is stilted and artificial. And because Colin is doing a kind of theatrical thing, particularly when he's being sort of pompous doctor, it really, really shows up the kind of flaws in the dialogue. And so when Colin's being silly or warm or charming, I think he's terrific. When he's being irritable or blustering or delivering speeches, I think he's terrible. And I think one of the reasons why Big Finish, he fares so well in Big Finish, is that the writing is better. And so when he gets to bluster and be pompous, he's usually delivering more realistic dialogue, and so he just sounds less terrible. But I think there is a kind of unfortunate moment where the writers are giving him things to do that they're not good at writing that are shown up by the kind of theatricality of Colin's performance in those moments. And so I find a lot to like, a lot more than I expected about Colin's performance, but I still can't get over moments where I don't think he's very good. And the other thing that I don't think he's very good at is conveying sort of pain or fear, because it always just ends up with him opening his mouth and kind of poking his big fat tongue out, you know, and I'm never convinced by that either. So, and the coat. The coat. The only thing worse than the coat are the moments where he takes the coat off. I just can't get over it. So I think that's a problem. And I think that there are structural problems with this story as well.
Well, I think it takes a 90-degree turn halfway through the story. I think the first episode is a complete run around, and we get introduced to Lytton and his team.
Yeah.
And we also get introduced to Stratton and Bates and their is it Stratton and Bates?
Stratton and Bates.
I think it's Bates and Stratton, actually.
Whatever. I think they're hilarious. I love all their stuff on the cyberplanet. I just crack up at all their theatrics of trying to escape.
Oh, yeah. I hate them so much.
Okay, so
one of them spends the entire time screaming at the other one in this sort of very, very, like, tiresome way. And the problem with it is their plot doesn't go anywhere. And there's this whole plot line through it that could just be neatly excised from the entire episode and make absolutely no difference to the story at all. You've got, you know, Brian Glover meets up with them. They're going to steal a spaceship. Presumably it's the spaceship that the Cybermen intend to use to go back in time.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. But it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, the reason they don't really go anywhere is because the scripts were running under.
Yeah.
That they're padding.
Yeah.
And I am not saying that in terms of their performance or in terms of the quality of their dialogue. They are padding characters who've been added in because the script was running under. As it is, in a way, I quite like seeing them because we have been told that the Cybermen have humanoids working for them. And it introduces a new idea when we realize they're partially cyber converted and they're rejects from the cyber conversion process. So it's like, if your brain cannot be cyber converted, they will still use your body under slave labor.
Yeah, they'll chop your arms and legs off.
Yeah.
And well, Saturday tea time amputations.
Well, is it any?
No, I know. But, well, we see that he has a sort of unconvincing sort of metal hand.
Is it any more horrible than what happened to Toberman? And that was Saturday tea time.
Oh, yeah, and that was terrible as well.
It is reintroducing them as a force of horror. And I will agree that the oft-discussed Lytton hand-crushing scene, it goes too far there. And that could have been done so much more effectively because Morris Coburn, as Lytton, has a brilliant scream when he's having his hands crushed. I think you could have just cut away to the cyber controller and had the scream and have it left up to your imagination what is happening to him.
Because there's a puddle of blood on the floor after it happens. I mean, it is absolutely appalling.
He's got bags of fake blood in his hands, which he just squeezes and they burst and what have you. The thing is, though, everyone on set thought it was a step too far.
Yeah.
Like, Michael Kilgariff objected, Colin Baker objected, Morris Coburn objected. But, you know, they got on with it because it's what was in the script. And it does present the Cybermen as horrible and uncompromising. But I actually think that Stratton and Bates do that really effectively, having Lytton's two policemen in the cyber conversion cubicles.
Oh, is that who they are?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
They're in there in episode one. That's really effective. Griffiths, who is played by Brian Glover, the bald guy, who's hilarious.
He's wonderful.
Getting a bit rough, is it? I mean, that is one of the lines.
I like the moment where the first guy who gets killed by the Cybermen accuses Brian Glover's character of being allergic to nylon, and he goes, no, I'm not. And, you know, there are a few really silly lines, and Brian Glover is kind of wasted on this story, but he is really funny. I think he's terrific. He gets some really funny lines.
Yeah, I particularly like, you said you were from Fulham.
Yes. Instead of Rifton 5 or something.
That's Payne, who's the member of the gang who gets killed in the sewers by the Cybermen. The other member of the gang, of course, Mr. Russell, the undercover policeman,
is Terry Malloy.
Yeah.
And I love his death.
Yeah.
When he gets hit on the neck and then has to do that staggering thing into position. I just burst out laughing. I just love it.
Do you know why he had to stagger into position?
Oh, was it something to do with the fact that's where they needed it for the next episode so they wouldn't have to pay him anything for the next episode? They could drag the body off?
That was part of it. The other part was where he falls, he covers the cord leading to the console. And not just that, as he stumbles and the camera follows him, he is always covering that cord. So they had to take that shot a few times. The reason we have Terry Malloy here as Russell, who played Davros in Resurrection of the Daleks, director Matthew Robinson, who directed that story as well, was so impressed with his performance, he said to Terry, the next time I have something on, I'm going to put you in there in a role where we can see your face because your performance is so magnificent, but it's even better with your face. So he gave him this role here. Of course, Morris Coburn is back, and in a way that won't quite work at the end of the season, the production of this story is structured so that most of episode one happens on Earth and most of episode two happens on Telos. And they structured the studio sessions in the same way. So that way, Terry Molloy was only required for the first studio session, and the Kryons, who had really complex makeup, were only required in the second studio session. It's a good example of sort of synergy for once between the script department and the production department to say, we're going to write a script that lends itself to being easier to shoot. They also doubled the location recording time, because starting with this season, Doctor Who started getting money from BBC Enterprises, now BBC Worldwide, I think, or is it the other way around? Because of all the international sales, John Nathan Turner and Jonathan Powell successfully lobbied and said, well, hold on, BBC Worldwide sales are mostly Doctor Who, shouldn't we see some of that money? So they were able to increase the location filming budget for this.
Okay, back to Stratton and Bates. As I said, I really like them. I know that the subplot doesn't connect with anybody else's. I would have liked Perry and the Doctor to have met them somehow if she got out onto the surface. But it is something that I don't think we've seen very much of before, where a subplot doesn't connect with anybody else.
I think that maybe in Resurrection of the Daleks, where we don't get to meet Stiles and their suicide mission to destroy the thing. Yeah. But at least that does actually have some impact on the plot, whereas, of course, Stratton and Bates and Brian Glover's character arrive at the time machine thing and the Dursk get killed and the whole thing goes nowhere.
That's true. The fact is they're trying to get up there. We think that they're going to get there, but in all respects, the Cybermen actually know what's going on, and then it's, you know, they are killed at that point, which is utterly tragic, and it does seem to go nowhere, but I don't have a problem with it.
I would have thought that the thing to do would have given them something a little bit more interesting to do when they reach the time machine, like avert something or do something. Do you know what I mean? Have them die heroically. But the whole thing just seems curiously pointless.
You see, I really like it because it gives you a moment of hope and then snatches it away. And Malcolm Clark's music in that bit, as they reach the door, it rises to a hopeful tone. They open the door, there's Cybermen there. They get gunned down, they fall towards camera. It is horrible, but I do find it clever, because as a child, I remember being really shocked by that moment and I thought they were going to get away.
It's a kind of Sayward thing, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, Sayward thinks that just killing characters is somehow edgy, and he showed that in Resurrection of the Daleks, but I think it's just kind of lazy and boring.
Yeah, I know you've been saying for quite a while now that Sayward sort of writes the same story four times. Well, Sayward writes or commissions the same story four times, so Earthshock, Warriors of the Deep, Resurrection of the Daleks, and Attack of the Cybermen. I think Attack of the Cybermen is actually the most effective of all of them, because Stratton and Bates, as you say, have no impact on the plot, but at least for me, I was sympathising and interested with their characters, despite the fact that objectively I can look back on it and say, oh, you know, there's no real point there. But subjectively, when I'm watching, I'm interested in what happens to these people. Speaking of people in the story who, as a child, I didn't think had much character, but as an adult, I actually listened to their dialogue, and there's some really witty lines in there. Are the Kryons themselves? Like, hello, I'm the Doctor. Unless you help us, you won't be for very much longer. I think they're really great. And I know some people, for instance, have raised the point that how could this race who require sub-zero temperatures evolve on a planet where they're out in the open, they die? Well, we've just had a run of 45 degree days in Sydney, dear listener. And so I can tell you, planets can get warmer. Remember the planet Aridius? And certainly we can infer that perhaps even the Cybermen had something to do with the changing weather on their planet. You know, people ask, how can we have a race that require refrigerated cities to live in? Well, walk into any shopping mall or any public building. We have refrigerated cities. We have air conditioning now. And it's a palpable difference in the middle of summer, walking into an air-conditioned building and walking outside. Not so much that we will steam to death outside, but
although we might.
Yeah. Yes, it's like that at the moment, isn't it?
But, you know, it takes that concept to an extreme, which is what good sci-fi does. And there is an attempt, possibly not visually, but there is an attempt in terms of dialogue and performance and characterization to distinguish the Kryon characters from one another.
I can't tell who any of them are, except for Flast or something, with whom Colin spends about, what,
an
hour and 20 minutes in a room talking about the Cybermen's plans. And, like, I think that's very boring. And she's someone else who has been injured and has green slime on her, which is a sort of feature of Sayward's stories too, whereas the other ones I can't tell apart. And there is a moment where we're supposed to care when one of them gets gunned down by a Cyberman and her name's Rust or Fust or something, and I don't care. And I also have to say that I don't know why the Cybermen are the bad guys and they're the good guys. And I think there's a real problem, and it's a endemic Sayward problem. We saw in Caves of Androzani that there are no good guys, that everyone's bad. And here it's the same thing. I mean, if the Kryons use the same guns as the Cybermen, they shoot Cybermen, Cybermen are constantly exploding and bits are coming off them, and you know, they're hiring mercenaries. I guess they're the oppressed indigenous species, and that's why we're supposed to side with them. But none of their behaviour or nothing that they say indicates that they're morally any different from the Cybermen.
Well, the two Kryons who deal with Perry and Litten, one of them is the one who says, well, we're going to have to destroy Earth. If you don't move, the TARDIS will kill you as well. Whereas the other one then says things like, well, we may not have to destroy the TARDIS, but we would rather the Cybermen didn't use it. These people are freedom fighters. And remember, one side's freedom fighters is the other side's terrorist. So I think not presenting them as these insipid Ewoks who need to be protected from the evil empire, but instead presenting them as people with their own motivations, and war has hardened them and taken away their sympathy, but not entirely, you know, so we do have them being sympathetic and being slightly sapphic towards Perry, if we can say that.
Doesn't one of them regret not killing her?
Yes, and the other one sort of chastises her for it. It's not just people saying, as you well know, Cybothuron. Part of the problem is the makeup makes them all look the same and the voices all sound the same as well. If there was more physical delineation between them, you'd be able to pick up the dialogue more easily. As I said, I've only realised the difference in dialogue and in characterisation as an adult.
I'm on the same page as you, Brendan, with that. Like, I see their different characterisations now more than I did originally. I like the fact that, you know, they are the indigenous people that are having to, they've had to fight these Cybermen, and now they're at the point where they will do whatever they need to do to stop them. As I said, the show does take a 90-degree turn, like in the middle of this story where you've got a big sort of action-adventure, I think, in part one, and in episode two it's more like, well, Perry's with the Kryons and the Doctor's trapped in that room and you've got cyber control and you've got Stratton and Bates, so it's more two-handers or whatever it happens to be. So I think it is jarring in the sense that it does take this turn. I love all the stuff with the Doctor and Flast, especially when she's talking about the Time Lord's agent is already at work and the Doctor suddenly comes to the realisation and is going, oh, like getting really angry. I love that sequence. It's one of my favourite sequences of Colin Baker as the Doctor. I just think he plays it so brilliantly, and I'm just chuckling away and laughing at what he, like his irritation and the way he delivers it. I think it's a weaker episode than the previous. Yeah. And you've picked on flaws which I think are out there for all to see and have been commented on throughout the ages. I mean, I remember when Dwim, when this came out on DVD, I think they gave it 3 out of 10 and just shredded it. I refused to watch the story. I bought the video, but I said, I'm not going to go and watch it based on what they've just done to it because of the memories I had as a kid. And I waited some time before I watched it. And Eric Sayward himself, like if you actually watch his documentary on Attack and you watch his documentary on Revelation of the Daleks, he contradicts himself. He believes that episode one is a great episode, and then in one of them he says episode two is a shambles, and the other one he says it's better than he thought it was.
Yeah,
and I actually agree with that stance. I just enjoy episode one so much. Episode two, there are all elements that I like. I do think the blood thing goes far too far, and I believe they cut it down in the final edit, but it's still too much. I don't have a problem with the Doctor shooting all the Cybermen because he is under attack and he is going to die, right? He is forced to do that.
I think it's a bad choice to put the Doctor in that position and to give him guns.
Ultimately, that's the choice that Sayward keeps making, and I think, yes, in the long term it is the wrong choice.
Yeah. But
it does lead into you know, at the end, the Doctor does apologise to the Kryons, I'm sorry, and there's empathy there, and I think it's a very powerful moment. I think it's one of his most powerful moments. But then in the TARDIS, when he says it didn't go very well, again, it's a downbeat ending, but I actually really like the fact that he acknowledges the fact that things just fell apart.
Yeah.
You know, there's a scene that's cut, you know, they had another scene where it was all light and fluffy and that just wouldn't work.
Yeah, sort of the TARDIS console was going to lurch again and the apple from earlier was going to fall. Doctor was going to catch it, take a bite, chuck it to Perry, give her a smile and a wink like the end of Twin Dilemma. And it's like, no, it's much better to see the Doctor really affected by the violence of this story. Like when he apologizes to the Kryons' response is essentially, look, just get off our planet. Enough is enough. Not blaming him, but just this situation is partially because of you. Someone I think does so well in this story in terms of performance and in terms of characterization, Nicola Bryant as Perry. Because in the first episode, when the Doctor is getting short with her, she's snapping back. Like when he's patronizing her about the Halley's Comet thing and she's worried about colliding with it, he says, oh, you're perfectly safe. And she says, not when you're this bloody close to it. Because, of course, Halley's Comet was approaching in the real world and people were concerned about it impacting the surface because scientific knowledge about comets wasn't as great then as it was now. You know, it was a minor concern and a childish concern, but it was something people were considering. And that last scene where she's trying to comfort him.
Yeah, I did like that as well. Mm. I don't understand quite the misjudging Lytton thing because, I mean, he never met Lytton in Resurrection of the Daleks or barely interacted with him.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, discovering that he's working for the Kryons instead of working for the Cybermen doesn't actually change how he's behaved. Do you know what I mean?
No.
And he did used to work for the Daleks. Mm. So I'm not quite sure, like, I don't think that I misjudge Lytton thing quite comes off. It doesn't quite make sense, but I do like the downbeat ending and I do like putting Perry in the position where she is. And in fact, she is doing the opposite of what's normally done, where you expect Colin to be alien and unemotional. And here it's Perry who has to pull the Doctor back and prevent him from taking Lytton, has to tell him to be practical.
Which aligned with Nicola Bryant's second interpretation of the character, because we've discussed how she did a big character brief based on Perry being with the Fifth Doctor and then had to rewrite that. And her perspective was, after the events of the Twin Dilemma, why would Perry stay with the Doctor? And the conclusion she came to was, he saved my life, I'm going to save his.
Yeah.
You're right, it's an inversion because the human companions of the Doctor have tended to be, in a way, his moral compass and to remind him of, if you like, ephemeral morality. Whereas Perry's thing here is to remind him, okay, yes, a lot of people have died, but we've saved the Earth and we have defeated a greater evil. She doesn't try to say, oh, all those deaths were worth it, but she just says to him, you know, we have had a victory, we have had a win here. Getting back to something you said earlier, Todd, even though it is locking the Doctor up in a cupboard while the plot happens around him, I love his scenes with Flast. It harks back to Sarah Jane with Alpha Centauri and coming to know and respect the alien who looks so different to you. And Flast sort of flirts with the Doctor and he's horribly uncomfortable, not with her, but with the idea of flirting. And at the end, when he gives her the lance to blow up the vastial, most precious substance in the universe, etc., the tenderness he shows there, realizing that when he then says, oh, well, I'll call the guard over, but hold on, how are you going to get out of here? He then realizes she intends to sacrifice herself. And as you said earlier, Colin is great with that tender stuff and bringing it down really low and telling her she's very brave and then running off and doing what he has to do. That vastial is a remnant of an earlier script write. And it's unfortunate that budget cuts prevented this from being in the final script because the idea was that the final showdown wasn't going to happen in Cyber Control, which is about the size of an average double bedroom. It was going to happen inside Halley's Comet. The Cybermen were going to load Halley's Comet with all the Vastial to create an even bigger explosion on Earth. And the Doctor was going to follow them in the TARDIS with the Kryons, and it was going to be Kryons versus Cybermen inside Halley's Comet while the Doctor defuses the bomb.
You see, that would have been great.
Yeah.
Saving the Earth that's happened here has been saving it from word peril by talking.
Yeah.
And that's really boring. And so the resolution of the plot involves lots of people shooting one another with guns. But the idea that there would be an actual, like, real, tangible threat to the Earth would have been a vast improvement over, you know, a bunch of people stumbling around a quarry and then a bunch of people shooting one another with cyber guns.
I like the idea that you've mentioned there, budgetary-wise, so they could do it, so they're forced to have a bunch of people in a quarry and a bunch of people inside control, and such are the budgets. Mm-hmm. All valid points. I can see where you're coming from with the criticism of Saywood's writing and the structure of things and that sort of thing. And I just adore this story. I'm sorry, listeners, I just really do. This is in my top 25 of all time. Yeah. I just love Colin. I love Nicola. I just love the humour. The violence stuff doesn't worry me. The cryons are just hilarious in what they do and what they threaten. And, you know, yes, there's stupid things, like the tombs look different and you've got, why don't we have those dark-coloured Cybermen? I don't understand.
Oh, why
are the vivification process, why is it all going wrong? Like, I mean, I don't know, but I don't care. Like, I really don't. I just sit there just enjoying it. And I know that most people won't and most people will criticize it, but that's okay. This is going to be a really interesting season, listeners, because I'm just going to be saying every story, oh, I just love this, despite whatever people say.
I do think the biggest problem with this story, for me anyway, is the violence of the last 15 minutes. But aside from that, I find it really enjoyable as well. I always have. I enjoyed it as a kid. I enjoy it as an adult. As an adult, much like Eric Saywood's other scripts, it raises a lot of pacing questions and plotting questions. Why is this here? Why is that there? Why did the Cybermen even bother to have a time machine? Who did they nick it from? Why do they never use it? Etc. It's off the planet at the beginning of episode 2 doing something. What has it been doing? But aside from all that, I can watch this and just in the moment enjoy it. I only question it after I've finished.
I just think it's really tiresome.
That's fine.
Take a bottle, dear listener.
Speaking of which, of course, Perry says in episode, I think it's in episode 1, these tunnels all look the same to me. So, listeners, you need to look out for those variations throughout the season. You need to take a drink. I'd like to talk a bit about the ratings for this story, if I may.
Yeah, I think that's important.
So 8.9 million viewers tuned into episode 1. 7.2 million tuned into episode 2. Doctor Who is back on Saturdays. That's a drop of 1.7 million between episodes, which is, you know, a substantial amount. And, of course, episode 1 was 71st, episode 2 was 104th. Now, at the end of last season, I just want to do a few comparisons here. Colin's last story got 7.6, 7.4, 7, 6.3.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the actual, you know, placings of those episodes, like the 6.3 million for episode 4 of The Twin Dilemma came 67th. The previous episode came 59th, right? So you can get 7 million viewers and come 59th, or you can get 8.9 million and come 74th. And then, like, if you look at something like Warriors of the Deep going out the first 2 weeks of January, it got like 7.6, 7.5, 51st, 52nd. But by the end of that story, it's dropped down to 6.3. So it loses about 1.3 million viewers over the course of that story. And so here there's a big drop again. Obviously, it's billed as a new season, a new doctor. And I know that at the time, and I remember it in the papers here, it was all about the fact that the TARDIS could be changing shape for the first time. So I think there's a curiosity factor of people tuning in for that first episode. I mean, 7.2 million, surprise, surprise, is the average viewership of Doctor Who over the last 2 years.
Right.
So it's not like anything's different. What is different is the competition.
Yes.
And episode, up against?
And episode 1 is not up against the competition. Episode 2 is up against the competition, which is the A-Team.
Yep.
Now, the A-Team, for younger listeners, was a phenomenon. Between 1983 and about 1986, it was huge. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have next day downloads. And a lot of people didn't have VCRs even. Mm. So you had to watch it when it came out. And often it would be like 6 months or 9 months after the US. It starred Mr. T, George Peppard, the face man, I can't remember his name, and Mr. Broccoli from Next Generation, who's not yet Mr. Broccoli. And so, I mean, I remember in our household, we watched The A-Team. I would really love to know what the viewership on ITV was between episode one and episode two. Like, what happened? What did ITV get against episode one of Attack? And then with The A-T coming back, was it this 1.7 million? Was it more than that? But it was a phenomenon. And unlike Buck Rogers,
which was really terrible
and only sort of was like 6 months and then it sort of died. And listeners will remember, of course, when we're talking about season 18, that's what Tom went up against. And it took, you know, 20 episodes for the show to rise above 5 million. And it was placing like 130th, 126th on the chart. Right. So you're losing a million viewers, I think, just by jumping across.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think it's the episode one. If any of an episode was going to lose viewers, to me, it would be episode two because you've got all that word peril.
Yeah.
And everybody's trapped in rooms.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a kind of narrative which is people are put off by Twin Dilemma. They tune in to see what the new doctor's like in episode one, and then a quarter of the audience never comes back. But it sounds to me that that's an unfair characterization of what's going on and that it doesn't take into account what's happening on ITV. And there's no doubt at all that the A-Team has a really much broader appeal in the sense that it's not niche cult science fiction. It's sort of fairly straightforward action. It appeals to people who you might have thought of as the standard Doctor Who audience.
It's got guns. It's got, you know, car chases. It's got helicopters. My sisters were like, they loved Mr. T and the Face Man. My sisters were watching this.
It's funny too, isn't it?
Yeah, because you've got, and I can't remember the actor's name, you've got Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica as the heartthrob, and he was a very handsome man. You know what? He's still quite a handsome man. There's a shot of him a few years ago.
Dirk Benedict,
thank you.
And can I say Dwight Schultz as
yes,
well?
Yes, yes, thank you, Nathan. I knew that you'd get it. I just can't remember.
There's a photo a few years ago of Dirk Benedict, and I'm terrible with names today, Starbuck from the new Battlestar Galactica.
Katie Sackhoff.
In a Starbucks, drinking Starbucks, smoking cigars together. And she put it out on her Twitter, Starbuck and Starbuck drinking Starbucks in Starbucks.
Really?
And he's still a really handsome man. So, you know, you've got, and this is stereotypical, of course, but this is how people thought of television in the 80s. You've got the action for the boys and you've got the attractive man for the girls. And to be fair, this is kind of what JNT thought of Doctor Who. You've got to have Nicola in a leotard and shorts for the dads.
Oh, that outfit is awful, isn't it?
She was so happy to get into the boiler suit.
But that's so hilarious. Episode. Like the cyber leader says, oh, we have done what you've asked, and they put her in a new thing. Like he's very fashion conscious. Like, yeah, yeah. For his captives, you know?
It's funny. A few sizes too big, and apparently the costume designer said to Nicola, oh, we're really sorry, it's a few sizes too big. No, it's fine, really. It's fine, because she really got sick of the leotards.
Yeah.
In terms of what people thought of this episode, even with the huge drop in ratings, the appreciation index went up 4 points.
What, between episode one and two?
Episode one was 61, episode two was 65, and it's going to hover in the 60s throughout the whole season, whereas some of Pete's later ones were in the high 50s. So people are enjoying the show. The people who are tuning in are enjoying the show.
I find that audience appreciation things from classic series are just so over the place that you really... I personally think you can't take a lot of stock in them most of the time because they just vary left, right, and centre. You just go, what the hell? You know?
Particularly as the show stops being a family show and starts being cult science fiction, you would expect the only people still watching to be, you know, anoraks who enjoy cult science fiction.
I think part of the problem, and it's not specifically Saywood's fault, is that it's very hard for a script editor to edit their own work because... especially when you are up against it, as Doctor Who scriptwriters always were, there was never enough time. You are not going to spot the mistakes until way down the line, possibly after production, because you've written it and you're too close to it. And I know when I've written scripts, occasionally I've come back to them and I've left out a crucial line because it's been so vivid in my head, I've forgotten to write it on the page because I don't think it's needed. And then I come back to it, it's like, well, hold on, that's the whole message of this play. That's the whole point of this scene. When Douglas Adams was writing for the show, Graham Williams had experience as a script editor, so they sort of bounced off each other that way. Christopher Hamilton Bidmead, when he was writing for the show, I mean, you know, we've praised Legopolis and Castrovalva, But in terms of structure, because they have such great ideas, it doesn't matter if they're a bit strangely structured. Because Attack of the Cybermen is a really quite a straightforward idea, despite the backflips with continuity, we do have that info dump scene, but that gives you everything you need to know. Because it's got such a simple structure, it really needs to be clear in what it's doing. It's unfortunate that it isn't, but I don't think it's a deal breaker in the same way that the Twin Dilemma was. Time we have for the orange gravel pits of Telos. We are trying to take off, but unfortunately we're out of Zyton 7, so we're going to have to pay a visit to Martin Jarvis on Vengeance on Varos. Do come back next week for that. And don't forget to subscribe on our website, flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we've recently wrapped up the Roger Moore era with A View to a Kill, during which we drank 4 bottles of wine between the 4 of us.
Yeah, not each.
Not each. Yeah. So you can find out for yourself how incredibly dangerous salt water is over on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. I'm going to take a moment for self-promotion because a book I have written for has recently come out called Hating to Love, Reassessing the 52 Worst Doctor Who Stories of All Time. In that book, I've written essays on stories such as Time Flight, The Beast Below, and Inferno. What's Inferno doing in there? Well, you'll have to buy the book and find out, and there will be a link for that in the show notes. I'm also in that book along with many other talented podcasters, including J.R. Southall of Blue Box. Until then, may none of your hermetically sealed heads not properly fit the girlfriend of Prince Andrew. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Even Better With Your Face, was recorded on the 15th of January 2017. The next episode will be released on the 5th of February. Avid font fans should continue listening after this announcement for a discussion of the typographical issues that plagued the opening credits for Season 22.
Can anybody answer me this question? Why, in the opening credits, is Attack of the Cybermen written in all capitals?
In fact, it goes on for the rest of the season.
Does it?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Well, not in the original versions, only in our 25-minute versions.
No, I'm watching 45-minute versions because what happened... This is going to be boring. We'll cut all this out. But when they were released in Australia, instead of the font that we use on the website, it's just Helvetica.
Yeah.
The outlines, the font's all wrong, and the part numbers and stuff. But what Todd, it is. It's all in capitals, and so is part two. And it goes by Paula Moore, and she's all capitals as well.
Yeah. It just doesn't make – yeah, I just don't know why they made that decision.
No.
It seems bizarre, really.
We need to wind up.
Yep.
I think we've got enough.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Wait until I get to Vengeance on Varos.
Oh, great. I'm about to praise it even more than this one.
I like it, Todd. Okay.